Welcome back, you're with Truth News Radio Australia. In the second hour of today's show, I'm bringing on a new guest for Truth News Radio, Kevin Annett of the International Common Law Court of Justice. We are going to be learning about the application of common law and lawful citizens' tribunals. This is a really interesting development in the, I guess, the movement towards a more truly democratic and a representative way of applying the law, something that I'm not really very familiar with, so I'm really keen to learn more about it from someone who's deeply involved in this. So let me just welcome to the show Kevin Annett.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
Look, really great to have you, Kevin. You're joining us from Canada, I believe. Is that correct?
Actually, right now I'm in the Midwest of the United States. I'm doing some lectures down here in the prairies. So, yeah, but
okay.
I get around a lot.
Yeah. Now, I'm kind of a bit new to this concept of common law courts of justice. Can you just kind of give an overview as to what exactly that is?
Well, it's really a very old idea. It comes out of customary or traditional law among people, especially in who are cultures derived from England.
Yeah.
The common law came out, and you know, it was kind of personified in Magna Carta and other, you know, laws which recognize that ultimate sovereignty and authority comes from the people, and the law should serve the people. The common law rose as kind of a defense of people against arbitrary authority, whether those be kings, popes, you know, other authorities. It really, the best way to approach this is to understand there's two really different notions of law and society. One is what's called often statute law, which is what governments bring in.
Yeah.
And it derives from an old Roman idea, which is the ruler defines for everybody what their rights are, and they can impose those rights or take them away. But the other notion of common law is what was in the founding documents of the American Revolution, which is that all these rights are inherent liberties. All people are inherently born with liberties that cannot be taken away by any government. And that's the notion out of which common law arises. Basically, the law is to serve the interests and the peace and welfare of the people. And, you know, it's, for example, a basic maxim in law that if you're not doing harm to anybody, you actually haven't committed any wrong, and the police and the government don't have the right to charge you with anything. So, I mean, it's really a very basic notion of what the law is,
And your application of it is one wherein citizens come together to form a court, to form a jury, and this is done...
That's
outside
right.
of the kind of accepted institutions, but within the framework of the law itself. Is that right?
Yes. There was a recent decision by the U.S. Supreme Court. Justice Scalia actually said that citizens have the right to convene their own grand juries. And this is what he called a fourth arm of government outside the normal judicial system, because basically you need a watchdog on the courts when they are either corrupt or not defending the rights of people. And we had a very pressing need to do this, because in the movement I've been involved with in Canada, which has discovered crimes of genocide committed by the Crown of England, by the Vatican, by other church and government bodies, the courts were colluding in covering up that evidence. The survivors of these crimes had no... place to get legal redress. And so we went back to our traditions and said, when the courts are not protecting these rights and convicting crime, then the people have the right to convene that. And that's exactly what we have. Sheriffs, justices of the peace can convene these common law courts, which basically consist of 12 people as a jury who are the ultimate authority. There isn't a magistrate standing over them. There's no judge. There's just the jury itself, which is the final arbiter of justice.
Yeah, look, it seems from a common sense perspective that what you're doing is a natural expression of true democracy, and it seems to adhere to the concept of the law, the true elements of the law, better than the institutions that we currently have. I mean, but you have to free yourself of the trappings of thinking that the law is all about empowered people, that the judge that wears the wig or the policeman that wears the uniform, yeah, that we all have been taught to kind of almost bow down before, because in a way that's wrong, isn't it? Because these are not really meant to be people, yeah, who are above us. They are meant to be people, yeah, who are of the fabric of society.
Exactly. And, you know, the traditional model that was used in the English system is that all people are under the creator, all government are under the people. And
yes,
the courts and the government and police are our servants, literally, and not a power over us. When they become a power over us, that's tyranny. And under natural law, you then have the right to legitimately depose those powers that are tyrannical. So we're standing on a long tradition. This is nothing particularly radical. This is right in the fiber of you know, kind of Anglo-Saxon law.
Yeah, and I think it's fantastic. The only question I have is what is the state of play? Because what I imagine happening is that these courts that you've convened, and I know you actually do it on the steps of the courthouse and things like that, will be largely ignored. Mm-hmm. The wheels will just grind on as they have done. The media, of course, will tend to either ignore it or they will just put snide little pieces about it, if anything. And right, as true and as principled as it is, Is it going to get traction? And I guess that's a question about the numbers of people that kind of sign on to this, because you're challenging the status quo to some extent. You're challenging the authority of those people who are sitting inside. You know, you're saying, well, actually, we here are the ones on the steps. We actually have the authority.
The authority relies on the people. And to show you the power of what we're doing, we convened our first common law court case about genocide in Canada. We named the Queen of England, Pope Benedict Joseph Ratzinger, the Prime Minister of Canada. There were 30 defendants named. They were given the right to respond. We did it according to due process. Yeah. They didn't respond. They didn't challenge the charges against them, which is really under the law an admission of guilt when you don't defend your own good name in public, when you've been accused of something. The final verdict came down in the same two-week period that the Pope stepped down. That was historic. And the first time in history, in peacetime, has the Pope ever resigned, in February 2013, 2 weeks before the verdict came in, finding him guilty and subject to citizen arrest. Now, we know that his resignation was prompted in part by the fact that all of this evidence that we had put forward, including him signing letters ordering the cover-up of child rape by priests all over the world, well, that evidence had gone out, and they knew, even if the media and the other people don't, he knows that evidence can be put into other courts and arrest warrants issued. So these are very powerful verdicts that come down, and you know, the proof was in the pudding, how he responded. He's still hiding out in the Vatican to this day because he's afraid of arrest. And so it shows you the power of what we're doing. It may be small in number, but symbolically and morally, it has great weight.
Yeah, that is a really interesting development. I'd like to know more about that at some stage. I should point out that I've had on this show, I've had a barrister from the International Criminal Court, or he's currently working on a case for the International Criminal Court. He's a barrister based in London. But it was very interesting talking to him, because the sense I got from him as a he was actually on the defense case for the son of Colonel Gaddafi in Libya, and he was appointed by the International Criminal Court to be the defense counsel for Saif Islam Gaddafi. But what came out in my discussions with him is that the International Criminal Court is largely an ineffective organization, but it seems to be one that that is used for political purposes, and they do occasionally convict people, but quite often they're unable to pursue cases that are, you know, quite clearly breaches of international law. For example, I raised the question when I was talking to him about indicting George Bush or Dick Cheney or Donald Rumsfeld for the invasion of Iraq, and he admitted that there was a very strong case for that. But for political reasons, it was unlikely that that was ever going to come to fruition. And so it's just interesting to see that even within the official bodies, that there is an incredible sort of weakness and inability of the actual apparatus to even function.
Right. Well, the general problem is that these bodies operate with a basic belief that heads of state, corporations, heads of churches cannot be prosecuted. And that is a notion which is completely false. Under any bona fide legal system, anyone is subject to prosecution for committing a crime. That was upheld by the Nuremberg legal statutes after World War II. Under the criminal code in England and Canada, the Crown, Elizabeth Windsor, can be held and responsible for felonious actions for committing crimes, which is relevant because she was named as somebody who had taken children from an Indian school and they were never seen again back in the 1960s. Eyewitnesses named her as such. So clearly, when individual heads of state and church do commit crimes, they can be prosecuted, but the ICC will not do that. And they won't do that because they are a political body. An example of that is one of the high court judges in England, who is a notorious child trafficker. I mean, he's involved in groups attempting to legalize so-called pedophilia. And he believes the age of consent should be lowered to 4, so it would be legal to rape children. This Judge Fulford is a sitting member of the International Criminal Court. He's an ICC judge. And the ICC last year shot down an attempt by a group to sue Joseph Ratzinger. This is why we started our court case, because even though there were 22,000 pieces of evidence showing Ratzinger had ordered the cover-up of child rape in the Catholic Church, the ICC ruled that they couldn't prosecute. So, I mean, these are symbolic bodies, and real justice has to come from citizen-driven common law courts.
Yeah, that obviously is what it has to happen. And that is, of course, an expression of true freedom. It is democracy in action. But, in practice, and this is something that I would want to kind of probe into a bit more during our discussion, in practice, this ends up becoming revolution because the powers that be don't like to be dislodged from their position of control. But if enough people get together, then there is inevitably a conflict. And we've seen again and again through history that that this has happened, and we've seen revolutions come and go. And we've often seen revolutions end up almost with replicating the same sort of injustices that they originally set out to overturn and to overthrow. We're going to break. We'll be right back. I'm talking about common law justice. Don't go away.
You're listening to Truth News Radio Australia, going beyond the spin, deception and propaganda of mainstream news. Visit truthnews.com.au and subscribe now.
Welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio. My guest today is Kevin Annett from the International... could you please read out the name of the organization? I've got the acronym all mixed up in my brain. Yeah, thank you.
It's the International Common Law Court of Justice, and the website is iclcj.com.
ICLCJ.com. Okay, great. I've actually got another website up, which is ITCCS.org. Is that?
That's right. That's the International Tribunal into Crimes of Church and State. It was the sponsoring body that got the courts going.
Okay, okay. So the so let me just quickly put that into my own browser. So it's ITCLS.
No, I, the tribunal is ITCCS.org.
CCS.org.
And the Common Law Court of Justice is ICLCJ.com.
ICLCJ.com. ICLCJ.com. And yes, do encourage everyone to have a look at that. So yes, the process by which we take control, the process by which the people assert their lawful right to basically run their own lives is something that you're more or less embracing this and you're taking it very seriously. My question is, does this inevitably lead to some sort of revolution, or can it happen in a more peaceful way? I mean, revolution doesn't have to mean violence, but typically it has. But can we have, as Kennedy often talked about in his speeches, a peaceful revolution? Is that possible? Possible?
Yeah. Mm. Oh, absolutely. Because in this case, you know, when you look in history, revolutions often were led by minorities. You know, one elite battling the other. This is a revolution of the majority. We have the whole notion of common law rests on the sovereignty of the people. That's all the people. And all they have to do is assert that self-awareness and sovereignty, and it'll happen. At some point, these elites do use the police, the army, and that to protect themselves. But don't forget, we are making a direct appeal to these agencies. One of the things that we've done is in our common law court system, we have a means by which we can deputize standing police forces to act as agents of the court. And so, you know, we intend to, and we've already begun to involve local sheriffs in America in these training workshops where they're taught about the common law. This is something they're never taught. And like with most people, they equate the law with the statute law of governments rather than the inherent law of the people. So, you know, there's a lot of education that's got to be done. But definitely, yes, this can be happening. It's really a way to reclaim what's been taken from us.
Absolutely. Now, what is the rule of thumb for basically differentiating what is common law, what is accepted common law, and what is, you know, somehow like an artifact or somehow something that's been added onto that that isn't essentially common law? How do we differentiate the two?
Well, you know, one thing that we've done, I should point out, first of all, we've produced the first draft of a manual. Yeah. Which people can read. It gives you the history of the common law, the philosophy, and some of the nuts and bolts. It's up online at the ITCCS.org site. Okay. If you look in the right-hand margin, it'll say Community Training Manual. And in there, they describe, you know, exactly what you're saying. The essence of common law, one of the guys to read about is this fellow Edward Coke.
Yeah.
C-O-K-E. He was a 17th century jurist. And he said basically common law is simply common sense. In the way that people adjudicate matters between themselves in civil matters, but also it has a component in criminal law whereby when common law is set up to protect the rights of the people against the encroachments by those in power, that's a specific function. So anything which upholds, you know, the right of people, like even the act of defining a right will tend to restrict that right. And so what we're simply saying, if people are born inherently free, and as long as they're not harming others, there is no restriction that should be put on that freedom.
Okay, that's really interesting. I've just got a few questions sort of buzzing in my head about law and what some people would consider to be universal law and what is often disputed, often with, you know, really, really intense passion on both sides.
Yeah.
And for example, abortion is one such question where we have, you know, an incredibly divided opinion on it. And you know, and I totally understand actually both sides of the argument. And I find myself in a bit of an ethical dilemma about the question about abortion because I'm not I'm not absolutely sure that I know what it should be. Can you just give me a quick take on that? I mean, would you consider looking at the question of abortion from a common law perspective?
I think any issue that the community thinks has to be addressed and adjudicated can be brought into a common law court, including, you know, that issue.
Yeah.
And it's not so much us defining what's right and wrong as, you see, natural law has the basic belief that every man and woman born have an inherent sense of what's right and wrong within themselves.
Okay.
And that's why a jury can adjudicate matters, because if they're not coerced, if they're given all the true evidence, they on their own will come to a just verdict. That's kind of the foundation of common law, that faith in people's ability to do that. So similarly, with an issue like abortion,
yeah,
put all the facts, the moral facts, and the other issues of health and everything before people, and they'll come to a just verdict. It's not up for us to define what that verdict is beforehand. We leave that in the hands of 12 honest men and women. So, I didn't want to evade the issue, but
yeah, that's it's fine. I understand our it's difficult. Approach. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Yeah, yeah.
It's interesting you take that angle. So you're not saying that we must accept a set of laws which are sort of handed down to us in a kind of a theocratic way or according to a religious document, you know, such as the Bible, or for some people it might be the Quran, or, you know, there are different cultures have their own laws that are enshrined in their culture, but you're actually saying that we do need to accept that citizens can decide what is right and what is wrong, and that we have to put our trust in that ability. Is that fair enough?
Right. That's exactly it. And as a matter of fact, in the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, it says, it addresses the whole issue of religion right in the very First Amendment. It says, Congress shall enact no laws establishing a religion or restricting the free expression. So in other words, they said, it's up to the people to decide how these issues should be resolved. We're not going to do it for them, and we're not going to restrict them in that action.
Yes, I think it's very important that the U.S. Constitution has those protections and that separation of church and state, which I think a lot of people forget sometimes in a lot of the debates about certain topics, because often the arguments sort of do fall along the lines of what people's, I guess, religious beliefs or their deep their deepest beliefs are, whether they even call them religious or not, whether they might be purely humanist in their outlook, but still passionately believe. And, you know, say in the question of a woman's right to choose, the liberal humanists, you know, believe that they are deeply right in saying that a woman should have the right to choose, what happens with her body. And then there's the argument there about whether a developing embryo is actually a separate entity or whether it is part of the woman, and whether there is a point in time at which it becomes differentiated and therefore becomes a separate individual.
Well, don't forget that the John Locke, who was one of the political philosophers that was, you know, very steeped in common law, and he was one of the inspirers of the French and the American declarations of human rights. He himself said that he coined the term life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
Yeah.
And they're not counterposed. Life, let's say in this case, the life of a fetus, liberty, the right of a woman to choose, they're not counterposed. There is a harmony there which both sides are ignoring. Your commitment to life and liberty go hand in hand. They're not counterposed.
Wow, that is quite an interesting perspective. I like the way you framed that. We are going to break. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. I'm talking to Kevin Annett about the International Common Law Court of Justice. Don't go away. Thank you. Hi, welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio Australia, and I'm talking to Kevin Annette. We're talking about common law. We're talking about reclaiming. We're talking about citizens reclaiming the law, and we're really talking about a perspective as well, a way of thinking about what a truly democratic, truly free society would be like. And we have the model, as Kevin, you pointed out, with the US Constitution, which I do agree is a really quite an amazing document, an amazing model, amazing template for how what a free society would look like. But of course, the reality has been far short of that, hasn't it? And
that's right.
Yeah, yeah. Do you feel that? Go ahead. Yeah.
No, you can go ahead. Yeah.
I was just going to ask, you're from Canada originally, so you're from a Commonwealth nation, and you've had a lot of concerns there about the Crown, and I come from Australia, and of course we've had a lot of concerns as well about the way in which the British Empire behaved on our land, and of course the entire colonisation of Australia was an act of seizure of land. And I don't know if you're aware of a very important court ruling which took place in Australia about 20 years ago, which was called the Mabo decision. It's known as the Mabo decision. But it came as a result of really grassroots action, pretty much along the lines of the sort of things you're talking about, on the part of some Aboriginal people led by one man, by the name of Mabo, who basically went to the High Court and said, you know, Australia was not an empty piece of land when the British Empire assumed it, when the British Empire took control of it. There were people living here. There was this doctrine, what they called terra nullius, which had always been applied to Australia. And the Mabo decision completely overthrew the terra nullius concept. And they had to admit in law that, yes, we did actually take this country from its previous owners by force. So they had to admit it.
Right. Well, we're in exactly the same condition in Canada. Terra nullius came from, it means the land of no one.
Yes.
And it came from an old Roman idea, which is before the Romans invaded an area, they had to legally nullify the people that were there because they knew that they couldn't lawfully impose their authority over another, you know, legitimate government or people. And so they legally nullified those people like they didn't exist. The Catholic Church adopted that in their own papal laws, which authorized the conquest of other nations. Any non-Catholic people were considered non-existent. And, and even though a government can declare that as being wrong historically, they still hold in their laws ultimate title over those conquered people. And that's why in Canada and Australia and other places, you have to say to those historical agents like the Crown, it's time to sever. It's time to say goodbye.
Yeah.
If you want to have real common law jurisdiction, we have to say those are anachronistic institutions and it's time for general self-governing systems.
Yes, indeed. And where does that leave us with the question about land titles? I mean, is this something that you believe needs to be taken to the common law courts of justice to re-examine who really does own what?
Well, right. It's very important because liberty is tied up with land.
Yeah.
There's an old maxim in the English common law that says a man does not have land because he is free. A man is free because he has land. And that's important because we are defined, and any culture is defined by their identification with the land. They don't simply occupy it, which is what colonial power said about indigenous people. They're here, they occupy it, but they don't own it. We do because we've conquered it. That's totally against common law tradition. And in fact, you don't have the lawful right to take other people's lands away from them. So, you know, returning the land to the people, that was in the Jubilee tradition that you find right in the Bible. Every 49 years, land is to revert to its original owner, debts are to be canceled, and there's to be a leveling that goes on. So justice is reestablished in the land. That's an old common law idea, and you have to address those issues in the courts, common law courts.
Yeah. I guess, again, to return to to what I was saying in the previous segments, it still seems to then depend on the degree of credibility and legitimacy that is granted to those courts by the citizens of a nation. And again, I'm sort of right. confused as to how we determine that when, well, I mean, I think it's a great principle that's being followed, but is it just going to just be off on a tangent? How does it get teeth? How does it actually start to change right. the whole fabric of the way things work? Maybe I'm just too impatient. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, yeah, absolutely. And I know the feeling because working on the ground, it's very frustrating because so many people hold back because they say, well, is this legitimate?
Yeah.
It's made legitimate by, it's like having a principle of liberty. You don't have freedom of speech until you practice it consistently. And you don't have these courts and this common law movement until it's practiced regularly. We've already shown in practice we can have an impact with the resignation of the Pope. And this new common law case we're putting together about global child trafficking, which names the present Pope and other parties as being involved in that very actively. So as we do it, we're finding more of a response. There's constitutional lawyers now that are beginning to quote our decision from last year. You see, what we're doing under international law is called a tribunal of conscience. It's recognized that citizens have the right to form their own tribunals and courts when the authorities are persecuting them or ignoring the issue.
Yeah.
So it's a matter of enough people getting involved, and we will reach a critical mass. I found this working in Canada on the issue of genocide. For years, I was kind of a voice in the wilderness. We finally forced the government to acknowledge these crimes that occurred, issue a formal apology, even though that didn't go very far.
Yeah.
And there was I saw in my own life, there was a snowball effect. We keep doing this, and the same thing will happen. I think it'll happen even quicker with this, because it's not just on one issue. Common law can be applied to any issue in a person's life.
Yeah, it's interesting. And, you know, we've got very similar things that have unfolded in Australia in relation to genocidal intentions of the powers that be, although it's not always directly genocidal. I don't know if this applies in Canada, but really there was an attempt by the colonial government and the early Australian Commonwealth government to obliterate Aboriginal society by basically genetically assimilating them, to remove children from their families as a way of diluting the gene pool. Is this actually part of what happened in Canada as well?
Absolutely. It's the same agenda.
Yeah.
There's an initial phase of genocide, of physical extermination, where you kill off about 90% of the people, usually through smallpox, germ warfare.
Yeah.
Then you corral the children, you break up the families, put them in these so-called Indian schools, boarding schools. That destroys the continuity of the generations. And then the third step is you bring in legal changes which phase out the distinct society. You get rid of their language. You basically, well, assimilate means to eat, destroy, to chew up. And, you know, that's what you do. It's a three-phase extermination. We're in the third phase right now.
Wow, that is really interesting. I really think that that you should come to Australia and talk about some of these topics, because I think that the way you've taken it to another step, which I think is the next step that needs to happen. There have been a lot of advances in Australia, and there was actually an official apology for what they called the stolen generations in Australia, where these children were taken away. But the evidence is that it's still going on, and this is incredible, because despite the apologies, it hasn't stopped. and it's actually not just only happening to Indigenous people. It's happening to people who sort of belong to a subclass of society, and it's a form of eugenics. I basically see it as eugenics. They're basically just, they're trying to control the gene line, and it's part of this technocratic society, this scientific dictatorship that sort of seems to be running things, that that they want to take over the way we breed to some extent. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. We're going to break. Very important show. Please stay with us. Welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio. My guest is Kevin Annett from the International Common Law Court of Justice. Now, Kevin, you've just told me off mic that you are actually coming to Australia. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Well, I've been invited by a couple of groups in Australia and one in New Zealand to come. It'll be in the fall of 2014. And I'll certainly, as the itinerary develops, I'll send you all that information.
Excellent, excellent. And so you'll be just lecturing about the whole process that you've been involved in.
Yeah, two aspects. The my involvement in spearheading this campaign for redress of the Indigenous people in Canada and how it relates. There's so many similarities between Australia and Canada on the whole issue of Aboriginal genocide. Yeah. But the second aspect is exactly the common law court movement.
Okay, that's really, really interesting. Look, another thing that's developed in Australia, we've had these official apologies, as I said, but we've also had a kind of resurgence of an incredibly intrusive nanny state approach to not only Aboriginal problems, but problems with people, I guess you might say, at the lowest strata of society generally. Which tend to be overrepresented in Aborigines, but there's also a lot of other cultures and a lot of other ethnicities involved in that as well. But it is part of a new type of total control of people's behaviour, where, for example, people who are on government benefits, instead of getting the money paid into their bank account, they get given a card, and this is like a credit card which can only be used in certain government designated institutions and can only be used to buy certain things. Now, this is done because the government wants to prevent, as they say, people using the money to buy drugs or alcohol or cigarettes or gamble. And so they say it's for the greater good, but what it actually is in practice is it's putting people into a very, very rigid, almost prison-like existence where they can only shop at certain places. Is that type of thing happening in Canada as well? Because I know these things tend to be global phenomena that when they get rolled out.
It's happening everywhere. It's part of a global corporate technocratic state that is really undermining any sense of accountability, democracy, anywhere in the world. And, the reality of, and it leads into why we have to do these common law courts, because we're not dealing really with governments anymore. We're dealing with private corporations. Governments are acting, and the existing courts are acting like private corporate bodies, not accountable public bodies. And, that's why they have to be displaced and go back to the original model of what government and, society is supposed to be about. It's happening at so many levels, and that's why we want to keep the issues that the common law court addresses very broad.
Yeah.
We have actually three trial divisions in the common law court, one having to do with children, the second having to do with crime, attacks on liberty, financial crimes, that kind of thing. And the third has to do with crimes against the earth, like chemtrail spraying, all of this stuff. And so in all those areas, we're finding the same enemy. We're dealing with a corporate system that's totally unaccountable.
Yeah, wow, that's interesting. Can I just ask you a little bit about the child trafficking? So you've got like a case underway in relation to child trafficking. What is your assertion, or what is the basic case? What is really going on here?
Well, we're talking about a global industry, and often today it operates through the government system of so-called child protection. We have courts that are being convened in five countries now, Canada, the U.S., Ireland, England, and Holland, where it's been documented that children are being targeted, especially in poorer families and low-income families, and are being trafficked for a lot of money to foster agencies, adoption agencies, things like that. And the Catholic Church plays a big role in this. As a matter of fact, the present Pope Francis, despite his liberal veneer, actually was involved as a priest in Argentina in trafficking the children of political prisoners during the Dirty War there in the 1970s. And we have eyewitnesses who were sitting in on meetings when he did that. That's going to be in the docket of the case that starts on March 31st in Brussels. So, you know, we're talking about a global industry. It's happening as we speak. And there's a darker side to it, of course, as well. And one of the things we're looking at is the operation of satanic ritual sacrifice and these cults that operate using these stolen children and, you know, verifiable witnesses and that. So, I mean, that's part of what we're going to be looking at.
Yeah. You know, there's been so many little stories leak out over the years about these pedophile rings. In fact, there's a big story that broke in Australia recently about an international pedophile ring, and there were two men who have gone to prison now. They've gone to prison for a very, very long period of time. They were caught. They had been living in Australia for quite a while, and what the important thing about this is that the network that they were part of is still completely intact, and and it seems to go pretty high up. It seems to really be composed of people who are pretty solid members of society. They've generally got jobs. They've generally they don't look like your typical what you might call rock spider. You know, they look like normal people, but they're actually engaged in these completely heinous acts. They're protected from within all of the institutions. It's very, very hard to actually prosecute these kind of people. But I guess having the common law court, you are freed from that, although you may still find that there are people even within any type of group that you form that I mean, because this is these problems are now so endemic in our society that you may even find that there are people within a group like yours who are part of this problem. How do you guard against that? You know, and how do you guard against the formation of interest groups, again, the same as what we see within the mainstream?
Right.
You know, it's
well,
it's
you know, there isn't the only ultimate guarantee is people's personal virtue and upholding that. And in a society like ours doesn't reward virtue, it rewards dishonesty and corruption. And once you have a different set of values at work and you have a system that supports those values, then it's harder for the criminals to hide in the group. It's easier to ferret them out. But on that whole issue, the thing to recognize is that child trafficking is an organized industry around the world, like arms and drugs.
Yeah.
And it operates, every government uses it. The CIA admitted a number of years ago that they operate child brothels in Thailand with government money in order to entrap visiting senators and congressmen who they can then politically blackmail. So governments do that all the time. They use all this. And so we're dealing with, you know, a political problem too, not just a legal one or a moral one.
Yeah, yeah. And it's you just got to summon up every ounce of your will and your principles and your courage to do something about it. Have you been like a participant? Have you been on the jury, or have you been a part of this actual judicial process?
You broke up a bit there. You said, have I been part of the jury?
Yeah. Have you actually been part of some of these proceedings?
Yes. I was actually in the first case. I helped convene the prosecutor's case because of my involvement in documenting genocide in Canada. I was in Brussels working with the prosecutors, and on actually, I should mention to people online, we have all of that evidence of the final verdict. About 150 pieces of evidence about genocide in Canada, which is very applicable to Australia. Many of the same systems would work. That's, again, up online at itccs.org. But I've worked at every level with the courts, yeah.
Yeah, excellent. You mentioned about something about chemtrail spraying. Can you just give me your perspective on that? Because that's one that there's certainly a lot of debate on. What's your perspective on global chemtrail spraying? Sorry.
Well, it's definitely being run by the military. We have there's a group in America that's bringing a common law court case about chemtrail spraying based in New York City, and they have actual former pilots who have flown these planes. They have an insider in Monsanto, which is one of the companies that produces the chemicals. And they definitely say it's a military operation, and the cover rationale is to combat global warming, so-called global warming. But there's more to it than that. We know that it's a means of helping transmit certain energy weaponry. So it has a military function, definitely. Whether it's more, there's been a lot of speculation about it. So whether or not that speculation is based on you know, kind of verifiable evidence, that'll be up to the court to decide. But we definitely have eyewitnesses, you know, who can testify as to what is going on with that. We know it's happening all over the planet, especially in the Northern Hemisphere.
Okay. Yeah. Wow. It's there are so many questions there that you raise, and I've had a lot of debates about this subject on my show. I'm not entirely convinced about the trails that they look to me as if they mostly could be simply ice crystals, but I know the geoengineering is a topic that has been used, and it's certainly a threat which I'm very much against, but that is something we might have to discuss at another time.
Sure.
Kevin Annett, it has been really great having you on the show. Thanks very much for coming today.
Thank you. I hope we can do it again soon.
Yeah, and I'll try to get your details of when you're traveling to Australia, and I'll definitely send them out.
Thank you very much.
Great. Thanks a lot. And that's our show for this week. We'll be back next week. See you then, folks.